This is a podcast extra from The Pulse. I'm Alana Gordon. Sunday, June 12, 2016, marked the largest mass shooting in U.S. history. It also marked one of many mass shootings around the globe in the last year. 14 killed in San Bernardino, California on December 2, 2015. 130 killed in Paris, France on November 13, 2015. 9 killed at Umpqua Community College in Oregon on October 1, 2015. This is by no means a comprehensive list, but these shootings have spurred conversations on our show about grief, gun technology, even the epidemiology of violence. What you're about to hear are archived interviews about past shootings that are still applicable today as the country remembers the 49 people killed in Orlando.
I'm Mike and Scott. This is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. And this week, another mass shooting, more violence, this time in San Bernardino, California. 14 people were killed. I'm sure you were following the news. I'm sure you've read the first slew of opinion pieces. Perhaps you've gotten into arguments over how many mass shootings have happened in this country in this year. So we were asking ourselves, what are some of the issues that we're not talking about, but maybe we should? Two things came to mind. One is that many people are advocating that we treat violence as a public health issue. But what exactly does that look like? And secondly, why is it so hard or really impossible to talk about this issue? We're almost looking at each other as enemies and not as a group of people trying to figure something out. Let's start with the public health issue. Gary Slutkin is an epidemiologist. He spent years fighting the AIDS epidemic in Africa, and then he took many of the lessons learned there to his new endeavor, an organization called Cure Violence. One of their most basic beliefs is that violence spreads like a contagious disease and can be addressed with some of the same methods. I asked him to explain that.
Well, it means really that we've missed the bigger picture and the detail. The bigger picture is that this is primarily a health problem, that the people who are doing it have acquired a social or psychological disease, and the health sector knows very well how to look for rare events and how to prevent the spread of rare events. This is a subspecialty within public health that's called disease or epidemic control, and it uses outreach workers, and that's what we use in Cure Violence on streets. We've done this in 25 cities and 60 communities on four continents. We have interrupters and outreach workers, and when used, violence drops dramatically. You have to find the right people, train them, and organize this well.
If we're looking at gun violence, does it matter what kind of gun violence it is? We often spend a lot of time after a shooting analyzing, was it politically motivated? Was it a workplace dispute? Was it a terrorist shooting? So does that matter?
God, I'm so glad you asked that question, because I'm watching the news myself and watching people searching for the reasons. And I don't know what the reason is that people want to find the reasons, but the reasons change all the time. I mean, what's relevant is that people are doing what they're believing that they're going to get some kind of approval in some space for, whether it's from friends or colleagues or from the internet space.
I can picture how the interrupter model works if we're talking perhaps about gang violence that is confined to an area. How could this interrupter model work for more seemingly random shootings?
Well, nothing's random, and they may appear to be. For example, school shootings, there are ways in which outreach can be designed where people can check out, you know, what's going on in dorms, what's going on in classes, and finding out, you know, who is feeling relatively socially isolated, or, you know, no, they haven't heard from him, or they're worried about this person. You end up helping a lot of people, not just who are, you know, thinking about doing something today or tomorrow or the next day, but people who are highly susceptible and might be thinking about an event that might occur, you know, weeks or months in the future.
Your approach focuses more on behavior than guns themselves, right?
It's a recognition that there are hundreds of millions of guns out there. You know, in terms of feasibility of interacting with this problem right now, we're getting reductions of, you know, up to 70%, frequently 40, 50%. There's three neighborhoods in Baltimore that have gone over a year, one a year and a half without a shooting or a killing. A neighborhood in New York that's gone nearly 3 years.
And how many interrupters do you have on the ground in, let's say, a Baltimore neighborhood that has gone without a shooting?
Well, you'd be surprised to know that it's only about 8.
How big is the neighborhood?
Well, this is a neighborhood of like 40 or 60,000 people. You know, this all gets mapped out. This is a specialty within public health called epidemic control. I mean, some of the greatest achievements in humankind have been as a result of public health. I mean, whether it's eradication of smallpox or almost elimination of polio, leprosy, TB, giant accomplishments. So I just think that the framing of this issue, people are still in the wrong. They're not up on the current theory of violence as a contagious health issue.
Gary, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Gary Slutkin is an epidemiologist. He heads an organization called Cure Violence that takes a public health approach to treating violence. And whether you agree with him or not, think for a moment of the person in your life who most opposes your views on guns and violence. Now imagine you're sitting down with that person and you're talking about what Gary just said. Would it be possible to have a relatively calm conversation about his ideas? Probably not, right? Sheila Heen has co-authored a book called Difficult Conversations, How to Discuss What Matters Most. She's a lecturer at Harvard Law School, and she says we come to these conversations with firm beliefs and we end up just talking past each other. So I asked her if that can be avoided.
Well, I think that part of what would help is actually to start with agreement, because I would guess that there isn't anyone in the country who would say, we don't have a problem. We have a problem with mass shootings. What we disagree about is actually what would help in terms of what to do about it. I think actually stepping back to give some leeway to, look, this is an incredibly complex problem. There are a lot of contributing factors. And if we in the United States are going to be able to do something about this, we probably are all right, meaning we are all correct that there are a number of factors that need to be addressed and improved in order to actually change the dynamic.
When you are having a difficult conversation, how do you deal with feeling offended when the other person says something that seems to strike at your core or your core beliefs?
Yeah, I think that trying not to feel offended is probably not going to work, because you're going to have emotional reactions in the conversation. The challenge is, can you recognize the emotional reactions that you're having? Can you name them rather than letting them actually fuel a counterattack or an accusation? So just saying, look, I find that really upsetting, or it sounds like you're not very sympathetic. If you can just name that calmly, then you can go on to add, you know, here's what I see. If you don't name it, you'll end up saying, you know, well, that's ridiculous and that's racist, or that's just shows that you don't really care about these issues. And so when we don't name or express feelings, then they turn into judgments, accusations, etc.
Given the highly political nature of this discussion, is there any hope that we can have these conversations and have them well?
You know, one of the dilemmas that we have in Washington today is that we have a lot of structures that are set up to actually deadlock the process. Given the 24/7 media coverage and given how split the country really is in terms of who we're voting for, politicians have a bigger incentive to beat their chest and block the other side because they believe that that's going to win them the swing votes that they need to get reelected. And that's going to be covered by the media. The more extreme it is, the more coverage they'll get. And that actually has a bigger payoff in their mind than actually working with the other side to get something done.
With the holidays coming up, is there any way to change the dynamic other than playing Hello by Adele? Is there any way to change the dynamic around the table when you are really disagreeing with people you love on some level and people who are your relatives, to not get into these fights and instead perhaps learn something new about them?
One of the things that I did over Thanksgiving was use the StoryCorps app, in fact, to interview each of my parents. And one of the nice things about that idea, which is that you're just curious about what's going on or the history or the views or the feelings of someone else, is that it puts you in the stance of, we don't need to agree about anything. I'm just interested in learning more. And sometimes when I'm at the dinner table, I try to put myself in that mindset. Like, we don't have to agree because we're not actually setting policy here over dinner for the United States. So we don't have to agree with each other. We just have to try to understand, why would you see that as the biggest problem? One of the things I've found useful in political discussions is the question, what worries you the most? And you'll cut through the policy arguments to get to, well, what I'm worried about is if we don't do that or do what I'm recommending, here's what will happen. Or if we do what you're recommending, here's what will get sacrificed. That question often leads to a much more interesting conversation.
Sheila, thank you so much.
You bet. Thanks for having me.
Sheila Heen is a lecturer at Harvard Law School. She has written Difficult Conversations, How to Talk About What Matters Most. You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Maiken Scott. On Wednesday, as law enforcement personnel scoured San Bernardino, California for the shooters, young people across that city sheltered in place in their schools. Lockdowns have become a common practice for school children across the nation. With that in mind, we wanted to listen back to a story produced by former teacher and youth radio reporter Robin Gee. She did this story in 2013, and she took us inside a lockdown drill.
I never did lockdown drills with my 8th grade students, but now lockdowns are becoming standard. Julia Gellarmino has a game she plays with her 1st graders. She calls it hide and seek. It starts with an announcement on the PA that Dr. Locke is in the building.
That's our special code, where you need to make sure your eyes are on Miss G and you're looking to her for directions.
Next, all 21 kids in their uniforms head to the bathroom. And one by one, they line up and squish inside the small room.
There is no talking.
On her cue,
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
All her students crouch down on the floor and become silent. Well, almost all of them.
So right now, I don't want to scare you, but Lily, if somebody was trying to harm us and you were making that much sound, guess where they're going to go first? Here. So right now, you weren't helping us to be safe.
These kids are used to drills. They're used to real lockdowns, too. Gellarmino says she never knows the reasons until afterwards. It could be a robbery in the neighborhood or something more serious. Since the shooting in Newtown, the lockdowns have meant some really hard conversations with her 1st graders.
How do we stay safe when someone else is trying to harm us? And they started talking about how, you know, we kind of play our game of, like, hide and seek. And One of my kids asked what would happen if they shot through the door. And so she had obviously watched the things on the news.
It's the end of the day now, and the tension of the school day fills this teacher's classroom. On average, at least 3 schools are shut down in Oakland every week. Neighboring cities like Berkeley and San Jose also use lockdowns, sometimes even for preschoolers. Often, teachers, parents, and students are unaware of the severity of the situation. Some parents receive a text when a lockdown is in progress. Other parents get the news through a note in their kid's backpack the next day. Troy Flint of the Oakland Unified School District says parents are demanding even more security.
I've received many unsolicited emails from parents, which were also sent to the superintendent and board members, asking for increased police presence.
But how does that feel to a 6-and-a-half-year-old? I asked Gustavo Hernandez about the drills in his elementary school.
I feel kind of, like, scared.
Can you tell me why?
Because if we forgot, like, to close everything, the strangers could get us.
But Hernandez says he understands they need to practice.
You need to, like, lose your fear.
How do you lose your fear?
Like, if you want to lose your fear, you can do this.
Reporter Robin G taking on the realities of lockdown drills. That story was produced by Youth Radio. This is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Maiken Scott. Last Friday afternoon, I got up from my desk and I walked over to the printer. I looked up at the television that hangs in our newsroom. I was kind of hoping to catch a glimpse of the soccer game between Germany and France, but you know what I saw instead.
This is an NBC News special report. Here's Lester Holt.
We're coming on the air to tell you about a situation unfolding right now in Paris where there have been a number of apparent attacks.
I checked Facebook. One of my French friends had simply posted, "Quelle horreur." I was born and raised in Germany, so I started texting friends who live in France. I stared at my Twitter feed. I felt sad and shocked and angry, scared. Of course, I wasn't alone.
And then I went to the gym after work.
And saw something on the TV with a breaking news update.
I think I saw something on Twitter. I guess, luckily, most of the people I knew who were in Paris kind of updated on Facebook.
Facebook had already started using the I'm safe tool, and Twitter was going crazy with the hashtag porte ouverte.
My Facebook friends started changing their profile pictures in solidarity. So did yours, I'm sure. All week, I listened to the radio bringing us the latest from Paris, a city in mourning.
But this is a Monday morning like no other. News has been breaking this morning about the attacks that were carried out.
I looked at pictures of the victims. I wondered why they were all so beautiful. Almost immediately after the attacks, another thing started happening, though. It's to some extent an age of the 24-hour news cycle and social media phenomenon. And in happier days, I refer to it as think piece bingo. You probably know what I'm talking about. After any event of consequence, we almost immediately start dissecting what it means. We discuss and endlessly hash out how we should think about it. Somebody opines, "Here is what this means." "Not at all," comes the response almost right away. "Well, how about this? Nonsense." And on it goes. We argue, we bicker, we leave nasty comments, and we unfriend each other. Now, here's a question for you, a theory. What if all of this behavior was really motivated by our fear of death? I've had a book on my desk for a while. Reporter Alana Gordon had urged me to take a look at it. It's called The Worm at the Core: On the Role of Death in Life. And it builds on the thinking of cultural anthropologist Ernest Becker.
And what Becker argued is that people are unique in all of the animal kingdom because we are so smart that we actually realize that we exist.
Becker died in 1974. This is Sheldon Solomon. He is a professor of psychology at Skidmore College, and he wrote that book on my desk together with a few colleagues. Knowing that we exist is good, but
it's also terrifying because it makes us realize that we're going to die someday, that we could die at any time, and that really we're no significantly more enduring than lizards or potatoes.
Imagine if our inevitable death was the only thing we thought about. How could we function? So Solomon and his colleagues built on Becker's work and developed terror management theory. It argues that we find ways to minimize our existential terror. One way to do that is to embrace strong beliefs about the world around us, to give it order and meaning, to be part of a tribe or a nation that will persist over time. Immortality of sorts. And because there's so much at stake here, we will go to extraordinary lengths to maintain faith in our beliefs. Solomon set out to test this theory in experiments.
What we thought was actually very simple, and that is that if Becker's right, if our beliefs serve to minimize death anxiety, then we thought, well, what would happen if we reminded people of their mortality, perhaps by asking them to think about themselves dying maybe by interviewing them in front of a funeral parlor. And so, for example, in one of our first experiments, we had Christian participants either reminded of death or something unpleasant, and then we asked them to judge other students who reported that they came either from Christian or Jewish families. And in the control condition, the students didn't differentiate between the target individuals based on their religion. However, when they were reminded of their death first, they liked fellow Christians a lot more, and they disliked Jewish targets a lot more. And that basic finding has nothing to do with Christianity. For example, we did some studies in Iran a decade ago where Iranians reminded of their mortality became more enthusiastic about suicide bombing and more willing to become a martyr themselves.
And Sheldon, how did you see this theory play out on Facebook, on social media, after the Paris attacks?
Well, I think it played out exactly as terror management theory would predict, and that is an outpouring of support and patriotism and national pride for the French and the Western democratic way of life. And of course, there's nothing wrong with that. More perniciously problematic, however, is the reflexive hostility and disdain for anything that is associated with Islam.
Is this always a bad thing, though? If I'm convinced that my way of life is the right way of life and it will keep me alive, it will keep future generations alive, is it perhaps not about terror management in the sense that I'm afraid of my death, but that I want myself and others to go on living?
Yes, I think that's an absolutely good point and one that we would not dispute. On the other hand, one of the things that Ernest Becker pointed out is that no culturally constructed vision of reality is ever capable of completely eradicating death anxiety. He called it a panic lurking beneath the surface of consciousness. And what we do with that residual death anxiety is to repress it, and then we project it onto other individuals that we declare the all-encompassing repository of evil. So the question is not so much, is it a bad thing to be proud of our way of life, but what's the psychological and physical toll that that pride takes on those around us, if that makes sense?
Since reading your book, I've been thinking a lot about my typical reactions. If, for example, I hear that somebody died in a car accident, my first question is often, did they wear a seatbelt? If I hear about somebody dying from a heart attack, I will ask, well, how old were they? Did they live a healthy life? So is this all about, I never quite thought about why I asked those questions, but now I'm thinking I want to assess my own risk here, right?
Well, I think that's quite right. And without claiming that everything that people do and think about is tied to death anxiety, we're pretty sure that lots of it is. And when you read about, you know, someone having a heart attack or dying in a car accident, you know, that's that makes thoughts of death very conscious. And one way to assuage our own anxiety, you know, is to hope that the person in the car accident wasn't wearing a seatbelt and, you know, that the guy who had the heart attack, you know, was choking on a half dozen donuts and so on, you know, in the hopes that there's a rational explanation for those fatalities that might in turn imply that if we behave otherwise, we could be spared that fate.
And that's not really possible with terror attacks.
That's right. They're specifically designed, and they do it quite well, you know, to tear a gaping hole in the delicate, culturally constructed fabric of meaning that we each rely on to stand up in the morning. And what all terrorist attacks do is to really hit us with kind of a 1-2 punch of death reminders. One is the very real physical danger that those acts pose to any of us. And then there's the psychological affront of realizing that our way of life is being challenged both physically and psychologically.
What do we do about this? We can't do away with the fear of death. It's part of us. But is being aware of it, does that make it better if I know, oh, this is just my fear of death?
The question, the way we see it, is not getting rid of death anxiety, but understanding that when death anxiety becomes problematic is when we repress it and we're no longer conscious of it. And then it's manifested in ways that bear unfortunate psychological fruit, like when we despise people who are different.
Sheldon, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Sheldon Solomon is one of the authors of The Worm at the Core on the Role of Death in Life. Now, on to another human quality that we see emerge during terrible times, resilience. Psychologist George Bonanno is a pioneer in new research on how we deal with grief and trauma, and the thinking in those areas has changed pretty dramatically in recent years.
I think what we knew about these reactions for a long time came from the clinical world, came from only seeing patients. And my work and the work of a number of other people has focused on the broader population. And what we find is that most human beings are resilient.
How does grief express itself in most people?
Well, most people feel profound sadness. And sadness, it turns out, is very functional. It's very useful. Sadness enables us to kind of process what's happened. We turn our attention inward. We leave the world outside of us behind a little bit. And we really focus on the fact that the person is gone, and we have to reorganize our sense of the world as a world without that person.
And then what happens?
Then this response is kind of cyclical. It's oscillatory. So we go in and out of that state of sadness. So if somebody's sad for 2 months during a loss, it feels like they're sad day and night for 2 months. In reality, they're not. Sadness comes and goes because it's an emotional reaction. We don't notice that because we're not paying attention always to these things. And over time, over weeks, that will gradually lessen. We still may feel sadness 5 years later, and some people often do. But it's a periodic, you know, an occasional feeling.
You make a big distinction in your writings on trauma about what we commonly refer to as traumatic events. And usually what we mean when we say that is a tragedy like a terror attack. And you make it clear that this is a potentially traumatic event. Explain that.
One of the reasons I'm very emphatic about that word is because surprisingly, a surprising number of potentially traumatic things happen to us on a regular basis. And we often forget these events. Human beings actually forget these things that happened. In our interviews, if you ask somebody, have you ever been held up at gunpoint? Have you ever seen another person die? And people will actually say no. And then 10 minutes later, they'll say, I remember now. I was held up at gunpoint, or I did see somebody die. And when we first began to do this research, you know, I thought this is kind of remarkable that human beings can forget these things. But in fact, it's because often we move on from these events. We're okay despite the distress of those events, and they recede into the background. So for any given event, it depends on many different things, not just who we are, but the many other factors in our lives, the level of stress, our genetic makeup, the context in when an event happens. And one event may be enormously traumatic for one person and not so traumatic for another person who experienced almost the same thing.
But in general, your research, even though it's on sad topics, so to speak, is hopeful in what it says about the human spirit.
I would say that's true, yes. In fact, when we began to do this research initially, I began this research about 25 years ago. I have to admit I wasn't keen on it because I thought, well, this is kind of depressing stuff. And as we did the research, right away we saw lots of resilience. We saw laughter. At the time in those early studies, we saw people laughing in between crying. And we thought, wow, that's kind of interesting. We developed ways to code that. We found it was nowhere in the literature, no real discussion of this. It was only seen as denial. But it turns out that most people are capable of moments of joy even when they're suffering greatly. And I think it really is a tremendous sign of how resilient we are.
Psychologist George Bonanno has written The Other Side of Sadness, What the New Science of Bereavement Tells Us About Life After Loss.
This is CNN Breaking News.
We are just getting word here of a school shooting. This is what we're getting from the Douglas County, Oregon Sheriff's Department. They are, quote, responding to reports of an active shooter at the campus of Umpqua Community College. This is in Roseburg, Oregon.
Micah, good evening. Law enforcement sources are calling this shooter an angry young man filled with hate. We're also hearing chilling accounts from students, including one 18-year-old student who says she saw her teacher shot in the head.
The United States of America is the one advanced nation on earth in which we do not have sufficient common sense gun safety laws, even in the face of repeated mass killings.
A gunman killed 9 people before killing himself after a shootout with police. New York Times columnist Nicholas Kristof wrote an op-ed that got a lot of traction. He urged the country to take a public health approach toward gun safety.
Joining me now is New York Times columnist Nick Kristof, author of A Path Appears. Nick, thanks for joining us. You wrote today a piece in which you noted that 92 people, we're putting that number up on the screen, 92 people are killed by gun violence in the U.S. every day, one every 16 minutes. But more interesting, you write about this as being a health crisis, and it should be dealt with as a national health crisis. Can you explain that to us a little bit?
Sure. I mean, we have a lot of...
He wrote that in America, more preschoolers are shot dead each year than police officers in the line of duty. He quoted the numbers for the year 2013. It was 82 preschoolers compared to 27 police officers.
Now, I hear all the time from people who say, well, what about cars? They kill people and we don't ban them. Well, of course, we don't ban them, but we do regulate them to try to make them safer. And if you look at the auto mortality rate since 1921, we've reduced it more than 95%.
Kristof went on to argue for more smart gun technology that could make life with guns safer. Joining us now is one of the people working in that area. Omer Kiani is an engineer in Detroit and started the company Sentinel to develop gun safety technology. He was shot in the face as a teenager. This is not something he likes to talk about in much depth, but he does want to discuss the technology. Omer, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
You have experience with gun violence firsthand. What happened?
As a child, I did have experience with gun violence, but that's not what defines me. What defines me is I am a gun owner, I have children, and I am a safety engineer. It was always easy to wake up in the morning and go to work because I knew that, you know, the work that I'm putting in is going to save a life when all other systems have failed. And that's what defines me. I'm a founder of a company that's developing the next generation smart lock.
Tell me how the technology works that you are developing.
So the first thing I'll say is most people, when they find out about it, they say, that didn't exist yet. But unfortunately, it doesn't. It's a simple clamp which disables access to a trigger by covering up the trigger guard area. When the authorized fingerprint are used to disable the clamp, you have instant access to the gun.
How long does it take for that fingerprint access to go through?
It's under a second.
Wow. So what is the promise of that technology and what are the limitations here?
So if you look at the gun violence in America, there's a lot of different aspects of it. But the biggest portion of gun violence is accidental discharges, and the second one is suicides. That's what we're looking to solve. That's the problem, that's the challenge that we're faced with. Firearm is a very simple and proven device. In essence, firearm was invented 400 years ago, and there's been very little innovation that's been brought into it. So what we're trying to do here is create a modern solution that will gel well. The reason a dental lock gels with the existing proven technology, which is a firearm, is because it's an aftermarket accessory. It's not a retrofit. It's not integrated into a gun.
So there is a new foundation called Smart Tech Foundation. It was created by Silicon Valley investors after the Sandy Hook shootings. What has been the impact of that?
So as you know, innovation is hard, and it takes a lot to get something off the ground. What Smart Tech Foundation did is it provided initial funding to get projects related to gun safety off the ground. There were three different tiers, and my company, Sentinel, which is producing at Denalog, was the winner of the highest grant. This grant allowed us to take a concept into a working prototype, which allowed us to further gain investors who allowed us to get to beta stage, and now we're tooling up to go to production. Smart Tech Foundation's grant and support was crucial in bringing this product to market.
Some surveys find that gun owners are not eager to buy this kind of technology because I guess there is a fear that maybe the gun will not work in a crucial situation. What's your take on that?
Yes, that is a valid criticism for technology that would be integrated inside a gun. Adenolock has a key override, which allows the user to always disengage the lock regardless of what the electronics are going through. Secondly, we have, 6 months of battery life, standby battery life, so we've done a lot to decrease any issues that could potentially come up with it.
And is your sense as a gun owner yourself that a lot of gun owners want their guns to be safer?
Yeah, absolutely. Because if a intruder breaks into a gun owner's house and uses their weapon, it is the gun owner's responsibility. So a lot of people are looking for a solution that they would be able to disable and secure their guns when they're not in use. There are existing technologies out there that, in essence, do similar things, but they lack the mobility or they lack the speed. So our technology combines the mobility, the speed, and the security.
Have you seen any other ideas, technologies that could address some of the other issues? For example, if a person who legally bought the gun, owns the gun, commits a terrible crime. Have you seen any ideas or technologies that address those issues?
Definitely. We need a lot of technologies that will each hit a portion of the problem with the eventual goal of eliminating the problem. With cars, you have brakes, you have active safety, you have stability control, you have airbags. You have so many different things trying to protect a human life. It will be no different. I foresee that it will be no different than in similar thing in the firearm industry.
But it seems that we're just at the very beginning of this journey.
Well, even 1,000-foot journey starts with the first step. So I think this is an important, critical step that we have to take.
Omar, thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you so much.
Omar Kiani is an engineer in Detroit with the company Sentinel. He's working on developing a high-tech gun lock.
This podcast special was produced by Paige Flager and engineered by Adam Staniszewski. Mike and Scott conducted the interviews. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Alana Gordon. Thanks for listening.